That binds more than 100 are killed, many more wounded after a bomb goes off inside a Shia mosque in northern Afghanistan. Iran says it's ready to send more fuel shipments to Lebanon despite U.S. objections. And also Israeli forces prevent Palestinian worshippers from reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque amid anger at an Israeli court's decision on Jewish prayer at the compound. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, bomb blast targeting a Shia mosque in northern Afghanistan has killed dozens of people and wounded many others. Locals say the blast in the city of Kunduz took place as worshippers were holding Friday prayers. Medical sources say at least 50 people have been killed, adding that the death toll is expected to rise as hostels are receiving more bodies. A Taliban official has described the blast as a suicide attack. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. On Sunday, an explosion rocked a mosque in the capital, Kabul, killing at least 5 civilians. The Daesh terror group has claimed the attack. Iran's foreign minister says his country will expand ties with Lebanon and is ready to help the Arab country overcome its economic crisis.
While respecting the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Lebanon, and within the framework of relations between the two countries, we are prepared to help and cooperate with the Lebanese government in order to enable Lebanon overcome the economic difficulties.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian also said Iran is ready to send more fuel to Lebanon and boost the process based on an agreement with the Lebanese government. He noted that the U.S. economic war on regional countries will not succeed. The top Iranian diplomat was speaking with reporters in Beirut following his meeting with the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement. During the meeting, Said Hassan Asso said, Iran has proved it's an honest ally and a reliable partner during crisis times. Amir Abdullahian also held talks with top Lebanese officials, including President Michel Aoun. Israeli forces have prevented Palestinian worshippers from reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque for dawn prayers. That's according to Palestinian media. The worshippers reportedly chanted slogans pledging to defend Al-Aqsa. They were prevented ahead of a general mobilization called by Palestinians at the mosque later on Friday. The Palestinians are outraged at an Israeli court ruling in favor of a Jewish man who prayed quietly at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The court on Wednesday ruled that the man had not violated law. The Islamic Waqf that oversees Al-Aqsa called the ruling a flagrant violation of the compound's sanctity. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation blasted the ruling as well. Egypt called the ruling a violation and expressed concern about the consequences. Jordan said the ruling is an attack on the mosque. Palestinian journalist Daoud Kotab says only Muslim worshippers have the right to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque under international law and agreements.
Well, you know, Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest mosque in Islam. And Al-Aqsa Mosque, like all holy places in the old city, is protected. It's a World Heritage, protected according to UNESCO and the World Heritage Organization. So international law says that you cannot change the status of organization. So Al-Aqsa Mosque is for Muslims to pray. And there was an understanding reached in 2014 between the former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former Secretary of State John Kerry with King Abdullah that is summarized in two words. Al-Aqsa is for Muslims to pray and for all others to visit. Now, clearly a visitor from the Jewish faith is trying to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is a violation of an understanding, an agreement, and international law.
Bahraini regime forces have clashed with people protesting against normalization of ties with Israel and the opening of its embassy in the capital, Manama. The protests turned violent after troops used tear gas and smoke bombs against demonstrators who were marching toward the Israeli embassy. Anti-Israel sentiments run high in the Persian Gulf Kingdom since Tel Aviv opened its embassy during a visit by Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Manama. Last Thursday, Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafa, and the kingdom's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, have already slammed a move by the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Bahrain is one of the four Arab states that normalized ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Palestinians have called it a stab in their back. And the U.S. says an imminent return to indirect talks with Iran to revive its 2015 nuclear deal is necessary because the process cannot go on indefinitely. State Department spokesman Ned Price says a diplomatic path remains open. He says the U.S. would like negotiations to resume in Vienna as soon as possible. On Wednesday, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said his country will soon return to the talks to reach an agreement. The Iran nuclear deal got into trouble in 2018 when Washington pulled out of it and reinstated sanctions against Tehran. Iran and the remaining signatories began discussions in Vienna in April this year to revive the accord. Those discussions have been stalled over what Tehran sees as excessive demands by the other side. Tehran also wants all sanctions to be lifted verifiably. The UN Human Rights Council is facing mounting criticism after it voted to drop its probe into war crimes submitted by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies described the vote as a blatant attempt by Riyadh and its allies to ensure blanket impunity for themselves. The institute said the move will lead to more violence and suffering in Yemen. An independent rights organization in Yemen reacted to. The Mawatana Organization for Human Rights said the measure amounts to a green light for continuing the campaign of death and destruction in Yemen. The UN top rights body ended its probe into war crimes in Yemen on Thursday. The decision has already drawn strong criticism from some countries and other rights bodies.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the Council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the Council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation. This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
Some Iraqi groups are taking part in early voting for parliamentary elections set for Sunday. Members of security forces as well as diplomats and expats are now casting their ballots. The elections will choose 329 members of parliament from among over 3,000 candidates. More than 25 million people are eligible to vote. A new single-member constituency system for electing lawmakers is supposed to boost independence versus the traditional political blocs. The elections are taking place a year earlier than scheduled time. That's an effort to respond to demands raised during protests that broke out in 2019. Those protests called for change and an end to corruption in Iraq. Wissam Bahrani in Baghdad says Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi hopes the new election reforms would make this year's parliamentary vote fairer.
Each candidate, for example, in Baghdad, where I am in the capital, has been divided into, say, about 17 different districts, constituencies, if you like. No candidate, for example, the candidates that are running here cannot run at another place. What that essentially means for the election is that before you had a candidate, people would rather select or elect the party of their choice, not the... If they did elect the candidate of their choice, the head of that party would not necessarily put that person who had been elected in parliament. He would choose another person. The head of the party could have chosen a different candidate, a candidate of his choice, to go into parliament. And that's what the protesters kind of said, well, that's not the person we elected. That's not the person who should be representing us. That's changed now. Mustafa Kadhimi, he's hoping that that's going to make a difference and be his trademark signature, if you like, to try and make some of the reforms that the protesters had wanted. The Iraq's highest religious scholar, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani, who issued a statement not the same kind of statement that we usually... The tone of it was different. He called for a high turnout.
Members of South Africa's leading workers' union have rallied into the streets of the capital, Cape Town, to mark the International Decent Workday. They demanded the economy gets restarted and the jobs of the working class are protected. Hassan Siri reports.
Amid the pressures of the rolling COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, members of the biggest union federation in South Africa have come out into the streets to demand a living wage for the working class. Not only have workers faced retrenchments, but corruption cases among top officials have exacerbated the situation. In one incident, the health minister at the time the pandemic erupted was replaced amid charges of corruption, in which millions of dollars meant to help curtail the virus was siphoned for personal luxuries.
Workers have borne the brunt of corruption with retrenchment and loss of wages in SOEs, loss of wages in municipalities, and assassinations of whistleblowers, wage freezes in the states, freezing of critical public service vacancies in frontline departments, the deterioration and collapse of key public service, and austerity.
Workers say the private sector has equally shown growth despite the apparent slowdown. Auditing firm PwC has described 2020 as a banner year for South Africa's mining sector, which is a mainstay of the economy. Yet workers, often those earning the lowest, had to endure cuts to their salaries. Government departments, meanwhile, have frozen salary increases.
So the municipality here must pay what is due to members, to workers, as it is, comrades. If they want to exempt, they must exempt their own salaries and leave the income of workers who wake up in the morning to clean this city.
With municipal elections scheduled for next month, workers are shoring up support to have their voices heard and to garner the best from whoever takes over the local administrations. As many sit at home without jobs, they have vowed to come out onto the streets again until the demands are met. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
A Pentagon official has confirmed that U.S. Special Operations Forces have been secretly training Taiwanese troops. The Pentagon official, who wished to remain anonymous, said the training has been going on for less than a year. That followed a report by the Wall Street Journal revealing the secret training. Taiwan's Premier Su Chang Chang commented on the report. He said Taiwan tries to defend its national sovereignty. Pentagon spokesman John Supple also commented. He said U.S. support for Taiwan's military is aligned against what he called the current threat by China. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and opposes the island seeking independence. China says U.S. military support for Taiwan threatens regional peace and has repeatedly urged Washington to stop that. Political analyst Andrew Loing says the U.S. measure to secretly give training to Taiwanese troops crosses China's red line on its One China policy.
Tensions has been rising because the United States seems to be dramatically increasing the frequency of these so-called freedom of navigation patrols, naval patrols near the, in the South China Sea, and it was also arming Taiwan with more modern weapons. And now, according to the latest report, the United States has been secretly training Taiwanese army inside Taiwan. That means the stationing of American forces in Taiwan itself. Of course, this is an affront to their alleged confirmation of the so-called one-China policy. And of course, the Beijing would never allow Taiwan to split off from the motherland. And this is an absolute red line, according to Beijing.
The U.S. Senate has approved a bill to temporarily raise the federal government's debt limit. The move aims to avert a historic default later this month. All 50 Democrats backed the bill, while 48 Republicans were against it. The legislation adds $480 billion to the current national debt of $28.4 trillion. The Senate passed the bill 11 days before a deadline to prevent the first ever U.S. default. The approval follows weeks of partisan fighting at the upper chamber of Congress. The Senate majority leader has accused the Republicans of having played a dangerous game.
Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game, and I am glad that their brinksmanship did not work. For the good of America's families, for the good of our economy, Republicans must recognize in the future they should approach fixing the debt limit in a bipartisan way. What is needed now is a long-term solution, so we don't go through this risky drama every few months.
Schumer said he hopes Republicans will join in enacting a long-term solution to the debt limit in December. He added Democrats are ready to work with them. The bill should now go to the House of Representatives for approval before it can be sent to the President Joe Biden for his signature. The extended debt limit will expire on December 3rd. That's when funding for most federal programs also expires under a stopgap measure passed earlier this month. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Trump administration used federal police and courts to deliberately target supporters of the movement for Black Lives in order to disrupt and discourage Black organizing and freedom movements, according to a new report by Movement for Black Lives and the Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility, or CLEAR, clinic at the City University of New York School of Law. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Report Says Trump Administration Deployed Feds to Bring Harsher Charges on BLM Protesters. Stay tuned for more. The protests and uprisings in defense of Black lives that spread like wildfire last summer after police killed George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other unarmed Black people were extraordinary demonstrations of public outrage and Black-led organizing. As it has done throughout the nation's history, the federal government responded to Black resistance with repression and state violence. The Trump administration used federal police and courts to deliberately target supporters of the Movement for Black Lives in order to disrupt and discourage Black organizing and freedom movements, according to a new report by Movement for Black Lives and the Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility CLEAR Clinic at the City University of New York School of Law. The report examines 326 criminal cases arising from Black Lives Matter protests in September and October of 2020, when federal law charges were brought against protesters in multiple cities. To delegitimize and disrupt the uprising while taking control of the streets in local communities, the report concludes the federal government spread anti-BLM propaganda and cast protesters as outside agitators, violent radicals, and even domestic terrorists. Federal police were deployed across the U.S. and protesters were charged with federal crimes, allowing prosecutors to pursue tougher penalties than a state or local law would allow. The criminal cases against protesters examined, 92% could have been charged under an equivalent state or local law, but the federal penalties in 88% of these cases were clearly harsher, according to the report. The crackdown resulted in stacked and trumped-up charges against organizers and activists, with many facing years in prison without the possibility of parole. At the same time, President Trump defended and even encouraged largely white crowds to gather for angry anti-lockdown protests, which were exploited by far-right extremists and inspired actual plots to detonate bombs and commit other acts of terrorism. The findings only confirm what Black organizers and movement leaders already understood. The federalization of protest-related charges was a deliberate and cynical effort to target and discourage those who protested in defense of Black lives, said Princess Massington, a staff attorney at CLEAR, in a statement. The report titled The Struggle for Power, the Ongoing Persecution of Black Movement by the U.S. Government, puts the federal crackdown on Black Lives Matter protesters in a historical context that was often missing from mainstream media coverage of the 2020 uprisings. Black power and resistance have always threatened the government's economic interest and the social order that upholds white supremacy. For more than a century, the federal government has either dismissed or attempted to suppress Black social movements in order to control Black mobility and quell collective action and power, according to their report. the report continues throughout history when black social movements attract the nation's or the world's attention or fight our way onto the nation's political agenda. We are disparaged, cast as villains in the story of American prosperity, persecuted and forced to defend ourselves and our communities against police, anti-black policymakers, and U.S. armed forces, unquote. For example, in 1960s, FBI infiltrated the civil rights and black power movements, putting activists and leaders such as Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Angela Davis under heavy surveillance. In 1969, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover declared the Black Panther Party for self-defense, which organized youth and community services in black neighborhoods, a grave threat to internal security. Black Panther Party Chairman Fred Hampton was targeted by the FBI's secret domestic spy program before Chicago police raided Hampton's home and murdered him in December 1969. The report notes that in 1910, 2 years after the FBI was established, the agency refused to investigate a wave of lynching across the South and said it had no authority to protect the civil rights of black citizens. Historically, black protesters have more often than not been met with governmental oppression and accompanying police violence as a result of willingness to accept the systematic disregard for and mistreatment for black lives, said Amara Inia, policy and research coordinator for the Movement for Black Lives, in a statement. History repeated itself in 2020 as millions of people mobilized for the largest mass movement against police violence in U.S. history. The protest began after Floyd was killed by police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis in late May 2020. The uprising soon spread across the world, bringing global attention to systematic racism in the United States and amplifying abolitionist calls to defund and abolish the police and redirect tax dollars back to communities. Clashes with police made national news, as did instances of property damage, which proponents of black liberation argued should be expected, as people who are systematically denied political agency will rise up against a racist system that has robbed them for centuries. Remember, the protests were against the police, and it was the police who were called to subdue them. In most cases, there were conflicting accounts of who and what caused tensions to escalate as police in riot gear unloaded rubber bullets and tear gas on demonstrators. In Minneapolis, Louisville, New York City, and beyond, protesters and activists defended their neighborhoods from police violence. Federal officials initially struck a sympathetic tone toward the protest, the reports note. But as demonstrations grew in size and intensity, Trump and his administration seized an opportunity to divide and crush perceived opponents. Trump threatened state-sanctioned murder in response to looting with help from his Attorney General William Barr and the Justice Department. The administration quickly began characterizing the protests as being taken over by anarchists, Antifa, and domestic terrorists. Meanwhile, the media continued to focus on isolated instances of property destruction and clashes between protesters and police, while largely ignoring the mutual aid and community organizing that was flourishing due to the demonstrations. Not only did the Trump administration's framing attempt to delegitimize a movement led by black activists, but it also helped justify a federal crackdown that in turn reinforced the Trump administration's narratives about outside agitators and anarchist cities. However, of the dozens of criminal complaints examined by the report that described the defendants' political affiliations, only one recounted that the defendant self-identified as an anarchist. The report identified more than a dozen counter-protesters charged with federal crimes who are connected to far-right, paramilitary, and white nationalist groups, including an individual who called in bomb threats to pro-BLM and black churches.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lifespan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Undoubtedly, a lot of sins and bad habits have a direct impact on shortening life, as in the case of drinking, gambling, jealousy, envy, vindictiveness, and there is a long list. Many also shorten it through indirect means, such as the resulting social disorders, lack of public security, and occurrence of wars, as in the case of usury, injustice, and oppression, so on and so forth. We have seen, for instance, America illegally occupying two countries that we can easily discuss. One is Iraq, the other is Afghanistan, right? Just recently, 20 years of American occupation, American illegal occupation of Afghanistan ended, right? 20 years, can you imagine two decades of non-stop oppression by America on the soil of Afghanistan? So as a result of that too, we see that there are very many innocent lives that are lost. Now, on the other hand, righteousness could lead to a long life due to its deep effect on the peace of spirit and conscience. Therefore, sin, besides its harmful spiritual effects, is also very effective in shortening man's life, whereas righteousness prolongs life in addition to generating other benefits and spiritual rewards. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the lifespan. Don't we all want to live a healthy and a long life? Of course we do. Now, what are the things that shorten one person's lifespan? You know, we listed a few of those. And then what are the things that elongate and prolong the life of a human being? We listed a few of those too before the break. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, early death of men is more often due to sin that for natural reasons, and long life of individuals is more often due to their righteousness than for natural reasons. You know, sometimes we just take life and death for granted and we go like, oh, just, you know, death comes whenever it comes, right? Well, while that is partially correct, but this is not the entire truth. In many cases, what we do with our lives is in our hands. Through our negligence, through our sinning, through our wrong choices, we end up shortening our lives. For instance, one example that, you know, all of us can easily understand. If somebody is eating junk food, is not taking care of his physical well-being, is not sleeping on time, is not exercising, is not working out, right? There's no mobility in his life. Well, naturally, he is shortening his life. Allah did not destine all this for him. He chose to be and, you know, live a life like this. And he's going to have to see the repercussions. We live in a world of cause and effect. So, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam here, he is bringing to us that in addition to the natural reasons, there are the choices which bring about the early death and long life in many cases. Of course, the topic is a wide topic, but it would be a good starting point for us to start contemplating. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
When an Israeli regime troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head or a Palestinian teenager or demonstrator or plumber through the heart, Israeli society is mute and apathetic, says Gideon Levy, writer, in an article titled, "In Occupied Territories, Cold-Blooded Killing of Palestinians is Met with Silence." Stay tuned for more. Scores of unarmed Palestinians, including children, have been murdered since the end of the Zionist regime's May assault. Yet this is now so normal. The Israeli regime media and army barely mention it. Superficially, things are relatively quiet these days in the Israeli-occupied territories. There are no Israeli casualties, almost no attacks in the West Bank, and certainly not inside the occupied territories. Gaza has been quiet since the end of the Israeli regime's latest offense there, Operation Guardian of the Walls. In the West Bank, the despair-inducing routine of daily life grinds on during this so-called period of quiet, which is precisely the irony crying out for the notice in this terrifying statistic. Since May, more than 40 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In a single week at the end of July, the Israeli regime military killed 4 Palestinians, one of them a child of 12. 2 of the 40 were from one village, Beita, which lately has lost 6 of its residents. 5 were unarmed protesters and 1 was a plumber reportedly summoned to fix a faucet somewhere. None of the 4 killed in late July posed any threat to the lives of any Israeli troop or settler. Using live ammunition against any of these people were prohibited, never mind aiming to kill, as did the Israeli regime soldiers who shot them. 4 human beings, or, if you prefer, 40 human beings with families whose world was shattered, people with plans and dreams and loves, all suddenly ended by some young Israeli regime troop so casually and so brutally. In case all that is not enough, note this. The Israeli regime media hardly covered these killings. Neither of the Israeli regime's 2 leading newspapers mentioned the killing of the 12-year-old boy in Beit Omar between Beit Lahm and Al-Khalil, nor did either of the 2 most important commercial television stations bother to report it. Put another way, the killing of a boy of 12, Muhammad Al-Alami, who had been shopping with his father and sister when Israeli regime troops leveled a stream of bullets into the family's car, killing the boy, who, like his father, had done nothing wrong. This was evidently deemed by some Israeli regime media a story of no importance and no interest. There is no other way to explain this widespread inattention to an act of murder. Consider also that all those murders since May were barely reported, never mind investigated, and you get a picture of the Israeli regime's repression and denial of the occupation via the media's version of Iron Dome, courtesy of the free press in all its wretchedness. Protected by a silenced media, Israelis were spared this ugly picture of their army and its brutal modus operandi. Protected by that silence, denial, and repression, even Israeli regime politicians and generals were not made to explain or even address the fact that rarely a week goes by in the occupied territories without Palestinian casualties, even during this relatively quiet period. If the troops were to shoot the stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage, and the troops would be tried and severely punished. Thus, until a few days ago, no army commander had issued any criticism of the behavior of these troops, let alone any mention of bringing charges or opening a serious investigation. Only after a series of articles and editorials in Haaretz did Commander-in-Chief Lieutenant General Aviv Kochavi communicate a request to lower the temperature. Not an order, a request, no charges, and no investigation, just a vague declaration of good intentions for the future. Behind all this is contempt for Palestinian lives. Nothing is valued less in the occupied territories called Israel than the life of a Palestinian. Draw a straight line from the construction workers falling like flies to their death at building sites in occupied territories with nobody to care, to the unarmed protesters in the occupied territories fatally shot by Israeli regime troops while nobody bats an eye. One common factor unites them all: the conviction in occupied territories that Palestinian lives are cheap. If the troops were to shoot stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage and the troops would be tried and severely punished. But they are only killing Palestinians. So what's the problem? When an Israeli troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head, or a Palestinian teenager, or demonstrator, or plumber through the heart, Israeli regime society is mute and apathetic. It makes do with the flimsy explanations and sometimes outrage lies provided by the Israeli regime army spokesperson, omitting any expression of moral qualms about the need to kill. So many of these fatalities have been investigated and documented and written about in the newspaper have evoked no particular interest. Shadi Omar Lutfi Salim, 41, a prosperous plumber who lived in Beita in the central West Bank, left home on the evening of July 24th, heading for the main road where the mains valve to the village water supply was located, after someone evidently discovered a problem there. He parked his Jeep alongside the road and walked back toward the valve, a red monkey wrench in his hand. It was 10:30 p.m. As he neared the valve, Israeli regime troops in the vicinity suddenly opened fire and fatally shot him. They later claimed that he had run toward them holding a metal bar. The only metal bar was a red monkey wrench left behind on the ground alongside his packet of cigarettes and a bloodstain, already dry when people got there a few days after his death. One week later, in the same village, troops killed Ahmad Ali Duwekat, 37, a construction laborer, father of four young daughters and a two-month-old baby. This was during the village weekly Friday protest. Beita residents had been demonstrating weekly for the last 2 months or so against the establishment of a rogue outpost on village land. The settlement, Givat Evitar, was erected unofficially and then emptied of its residents by the Zionist regime, but 40 structures rapidly built there were not demolished. The land has been returned to its owners, who are not allowed to come near it. Since Givat Evitar was launched over 10 weeks ago, 5 Palestinian protesters have already been killed there by the Zionist regime troops. None of the 5 was close enough to endanger the troops in any way, even as demonstrators were throwing stones and burning tires to protest against the takeover of their land. The residents are determined to continue resisting until their lands will return to them. And meanwhile, the blood flows week after week. The Wekoat was drinking a glass of water when an Israeli regime sniper chose him, apparently at random, and shot him through the heart from a distance of several hundred meters. The bullet exploded inside his body, damaging his internal organs, and Duwekat died on the spot, blood pouring from his mouth. His baby boy, Ali, was made an orphan soon after his birth. few weeks earlier, the Zionist regime troops shot teenager Muhammad Munir al-Tamimi from another protesting village, Nabi Saleh, and killed him. Tamimi was 17 and became his small village fifth fatality in the last few years. Everyone in the community belongs to the Tamimi family, and for years now, they have been resisting the theft of their lands by the surrounding settlements. These deaths were all executions. There is no other way to describe them. Shooting unarmed protesters, teenagers, children, a plumber, a construction laborer, people demonstrating publicly in the quest to regain their property and their freedom is a crime. Even the grumbling head here and there and the systematic killing has to do with whether it might lead to a deterioration in the situation overall. On the question of the legality and especially the morality of the matter of innocence, nobody says a word. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM. 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. This is a very great and important day in history. It is the day of the migration of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or what is known as the Hijrah, when the Holy Prophet in the dead of night decided to travel from Mecca to Medina by the request and by the invitation of a group of people from Medina. This is the day that the Holy Prophet decided to, you know, depart Mecca. And obviously we know there are many different amazing events that occurred in this particular regard that have been mentioned in the books of history regarding the event of the migration, starting with obviously the remaining in the bed of the Holy Prophet, Ma Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and then obviously the events of the cave of Hira before the cave, and so on and so forth. And in this regard, we see that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam also has a very beautiful tradition in this regard, that migration obviously has to be for a particular purpose. And some of the traditions mention migration or, you know, traveling from one place to another for the purpose of education, for example. And we have certain traditions in that regard. Or, for example, to escape certain oppressors, for example. And we have many of these types of hijrat in the Islamic history. But the one that we would like to mention today is that type of migration or hijra that is for the protection of religion. And this is what we can, you know, cast the migration of the Holy Prophet as one of the reasons why the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam left Mecca for Medina, is because of the protection of the Islam, for the protection of the Islamic ideology, and obviously then to spread it in that particular place that was more inviting, that was more open to hearing new ideas about this beautiful religion that you and I follow today. So the Holy Prophet is reported to have said that that person, in order to protect his religion, his beliefs, he travels from one place to another. Right? So he moves, so he migrates basically, or he, what is known as, he does a hijrah. Right? He moves from one place to another. Because why? To protect his religion. This person is worthy of attaining paradise. This is very important, that the reason for migration must be of importance. And obviously one of the main important reasons for us to migrate is in order to protect our religion. And this is something that is, you know, quite, you know, rife in our communities today, and discussions are happening. Obviously this is not the program to do ta'in or the specifications of what a person must or must not do. A person must obviously go to those who are more knowledgeable and obviously consider it themselves. But in order to protect one's religion, one's deen, one's belief, one's ritual, the essence of it, not just the form of it, the essence of it, a person should migrate according to this tradition. And if a person does do so, paradise will be, you know, something that he is deserving of, something that he is worthy of, or her. Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no
Spotlight.